Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, why the student loan debt crisis may only deepen. Now, you've heard the numbers, $1.5 trillion in borrowed money for higher education and default rates predicted to rise into the mid-30% range in the next 5 years. Here's one more thing to know. The next graduation or generation of graduates may be less prepared to make good on their loans, and we're going to talk about why. So what that leaves us with are increasing numbers of Americans who know some kind of higher education or advanced training is really important, but who don't feel that what they're spending on it is a fair bargain. Either their job doesn't pay what they hoped it would, or loan forgiveness didn't work out as they thought it would, or the four-year degree, which cost a lot of money, isn't enough to work in the field that they want to work in. Today, a discussion about how that student loan bargain feels to you. And I anticipate that you'll have a lot to say about this. I want to know this. Do you think what you spent and borrowed for higher education or advanced training has ended up being a fair bargain for you? And I would ask you to think about that both short-term and long-term. Not only the immediate pain of making the monthly payments, but the long-term implications of what you'll get out of that degree or certification. So just to say, and I'll cover this with my guests, this is not a show about, oh, that degree wasn't worth it, no need to go get higher education. It's a show about the fact how higher education is necessary and some kind of advanced certification is necessary. But is it a fair bargain? What you're paying to get that education, what you're paying to get that advanced training, is it worth it? What do we do about that? Tell me a bit about your own experience. I think we're going to have a lot of calls, so keep it as concise as you can. But I'm really interested to hear how this fits into your life. So here's the phone number, 651-227-6000. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Our guest, Julie Margetta Morgan, is a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute, where she specializes in college affordability and financing issues, and she's with us from Seattle. And Julie, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Feniba Otto is with us, assistant professor of consumer science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and she's with us today from Madison. And Feniba, welcome to you. Good to have you on the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Feniba, I want to come back to this. I don't want anybody to start the show thinking, well, they're on the Carrie's saying it's not worth getting a higher education. I am not saying this. I'm saying certification, some kind of advanced training, higher ed is important, and I'd like to know how you think about the question of worth and what you pay for it.
I'm so pleased that you started off by making that disclaimer okay. About this topic and where we're going with this discussion today, because when I present on these topics, I often have to assert that it is important to understand that it is pretty consistent across most studies that the returns to a college degree, so obtaining the college degree, are worth it if we look at the returns based on, labor market wages, lifetime earnings, for example. So, going to college and obtaining the college degree, which is important, I'm going to keep underlining the obtaining the degree, is consistently seen as worth the investment, the time investment. So where we are probably going to take this conversation is the associated risk, the financial risk of pursuing a college degree.
Yeah. And Julie, the conversation is not going to be, well, you can only spend this much and that's how you decide, because admittedly, a higher education experience or advanced training experience is valuable for a lot of different reasons. But I do want to get into how you assess, as Feniba says, the risk, the financial risk, with what you come out of it on the other side, and the long-term consequences of that as well. So tell me how you think about that.
Yeah, so in the paper that Roosevelt recently put out with me and my colleague Marshall Steinbaum, we wanted to be really clear on this point as well, that a college degree is not only worth it, but required in a lot of cases. But we wanted to take a little bit more nuanced look at it. So why is it that a college degree is so essential? And so as Seneva noted, you know, we often tell families that there's a big wage premium or earnings premium from attaining a college degree. It used to be you got $1 million more over your lifetime. Now it's a little bit less than that. But our work tries to emphasize that, you know, we need to understand the nuances of where that $1 million or $900,000 comes from. And we see that it's not necessarily that a higher education is becoming more and more worth it. It's also because just getting a high school diploma and heading out into the workforce with just that is becoming less and less worth it. So as you noted at the beginning of the show, it really is a story of you can't, you know, in some cases you can't afford to get a degree, but you really can't afford not to get a degree.
I know.
Because having a high school diploma is unsustainable.
You're in a spot with that, and I sympathize with that, and we're going to come back to why that is, but we have so many people on the phone lines that let me start hearing from some of our listeners. To Bill in Duluth. Hi, Bill. How does this fit into your life?
Hi. I'm a firefighter from Duluth here, and I just recently got my license from Lake Superior College. I haven't found a home yet at a fire station, but I have to say that going to college and getting a certification in firefighting, it's only a two-year program, but I find that even in just the usual workforce, not even the fire service itself, that employers look at me as more of an asset now. Things like using an AED and being able to perform CPR, safety in the workplace, are all things that employers are looking for. And I find now that a lot of my friends in this area, they're potentially on, you know, food stamps, or they're using food pantries just because they're having a hard time making ends meet on a GED or a, you know, just a diploma at entry-level jobs. They're not making any advancements anywhere. It's really dead end. And I feel like going to college is almost a necessity, but it's a really tough one because it's so hard to afford.
Yeah. So Bill, I'm just curious about this. You went to get your firefighting certificate first, and then you went on for, what, a four-year degree, or how did this work?
Sure. So the way the college has it set up is it's a AAS degree, and you can go there for 2 years. You do a little reading, writing, and arithmetic, but it's all mixed in with a firefighting curriculum. So you do get all the license and certifications to go out into the workforce and search for jobs almost within the first year. But the second year, you do attain a college degree, which is basically good for anything.
Yeah. So Bill, may I ask, give me a range about what you spent on all of that.
Sure. I'm about $9,000 in debt right now.
Okay.
And that weighs heavily on me. Luckily, I have a really supporting family, and they've been trying to help out with what they can pay for. But yeah, about $9,000 is what I've spent so far.
Not overwhelming, but yeah, you have to think about that and you have to pay on it for a while. Bill, I really appreciate the call. Feniba, I want to come back to something that you and Julie have noted, which is a high school diploma just isn't going to do it in this economy. There was a time when it would have. Why have things changed?
So Bill's story speaks to, and the stories of his friends that he referenced speaks to the work that Julie has done, and what we've been looking at is this increased return on the college degree. And what we're seeing is that the need, and even some of Trustee McMillan Cotton's work talks about the idea of this increased need for credentialing, right? The signaling on the labor market as transferred through post-secondary education and the degrees. So not, even beyond, you know, like the four-year or two-year degrees, the need for certificates and, you know, all this additional schooling, right? And employers are looking for this. And if individuals don't have aren't achieving or aren't investing in these additional credentialing, then they're not providing the signals, the right signals on the market that employers are looking for.
Except that, right. Julie, I was looking at degree attainment and median income. And if you can see these graphs where the median income for a bachelor degree level job flattened out or dipped between 1999 to 2017. So you're not necessarily in getting that degree going to keep climbing the income scale, even though, as we're all saying, you really need some kind of certification or degree. What's going on with that?
Well, I think there's two sides of the equation. So one side, as Bill pointed out, is that employers really want to see this level of education. They appreciate those skills and they value them in the sense that they'd be happy to have you come work for them, right? But the other side of the equation is, do they value them in the sense that they actually are paying you more for those skills? And our research suggests that, you know, on the whole, employers are tending to happily accept the advanced skills that you got, but not necessarily reward those skills with a significant increase in earnings.
Call here from Suzanne in Minnetonka. Hi, Suzanne. Sounds like you went to your alma mater is where Fenneba is coming to us from today. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I went to Madison, okay. And I actually chose Madison over the University of Chicago for cost. Uh-huh. I absolutely adored it, though, of course, in the end. But I have kind of two interesting perspectives. My siblings and I span about a 12-year gap, and I have siblings that went to both Berkeley and Stanford within that 12-year gap. So price certainly at Berkeley was more expensive than Madison, but then as you jump ahead 10, 12 years, Stanford was significantly more expensive even than Berkeley. And my brother that went to Stanford, you know, he's got a physics degree. He's got a beautiful education. He doesn't regret it in the slightest, but, you know, he's got a house payment. What people don't realize is that, and the other perspective is kind of where I know about this, I run and own an ACT prep tutoring company. And so what people don't realize, a lot of my clientele fall into the category of families who make enough money that they don't qualify for federal loans, federal grants, and that type of financial support that schools believe that they're capable of, the families are capable of contributing a significant amount to their students' education. But in reality, the families are not able to contribute that dollar amount yearly to the students' education. So then a lot of those students will end up taking out private loans that don't have the same deferment options should the student want to go on and do a master's or, you know, an additional education. So now they're paying back those loans. Interest rates are higher. And so now we're having conversations about, you know, limiting options based on finance, limiting degree options based on finance, instead of going away to college and picking a liberal arts degree that really just gives you that breadth of humanities. Now we're talking about choosing a career path to ensure that you have a job that is marketable. And there's nothing wrong with having to make those choices, but I find it somewhat unfortunate that I have to counsel my students, you know, into that path, because now we're talking about schools that are $60,000, $65,000 a year.
Wow.
Which is a tremendous amount of money after four years, especially if a student wants to go on to higher education after that.
So just so I'm clear on that, your counsel to your parents and these students is yes, you could get into the Stanfords, Berkeleys, whatever, I think you're doing them a service, Suzanne.
Oh, I believe. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It's I have no hesitation making the comment. But at the same time, you know, while there's nothing wrong, I mean, I adored my Madison education. I have no regrets choosing it over Chicago. There are students that are in love with the idea of going to a Stanford or a Yale.
Well, of course.
And they've visited and they feel at home in that environment. And you know, they're saddened to think that they have to take themselves elsewhere simply because of money.
Yeah. I'm really interested in what Julie and Fenneba are hearing with this. Julie, what do you hear in the way she's counseling her clients on this?
Well, I mean, I hear that families are having to make really tough economic choices around where to send their kids to college. My doctoral research many years ago was around how parents and students make these choices. Mm-hmm. And my biggest concern there is that most of them don't have the full information. We've made the process of applying to college and the in particular the financial question so opaque that many families are making this decision based on what they know, but it's not the full story about how to pay.
Amen.
And so they end up with surprises down the road in either direction. Some end up thinking that it's going to be affordable and taking on too much debt, and then others end up unnecessarily limiting their choices. So, you know, what speaks to me there is that we need to make the system a lot more clear because the choices that are limited the most are the choices for the students who are traditionally underrepresented in our higher education system to begin with.
Yeah, Fenneva, just for a moment, I also want to talk about other students of color and how they experience this. But just to say, I can't tell you how many college presidents we've had on the show. When we try to talk about transparency, they'll say, well, that's not the... You know, that's the first price, but that's not the price most. Why? It's like health care. Why is this so opaque for families that are trying to make the right informed decisions?
Wow.
Yeah.
because calculating the long term, as you said at the beginning, short and long term payoffs, is a difficult calculation. But it doesn't, as Julie has said, it doesn't have to be that opaque to know the sticker price, right? To understand how much loans you have to take. I know I can speak to some of the work that we've done around looking at debt accumulation and family, family contribution, financial contribution, mm-hmm. and looking at how it's largely based on income and not on wealth, right? So families, as the caller who called in spoke about, you know, families' expected financial contribution sometimes falls a lot higher than they actually have on their financial balance sheets, right? So they have to start supplementing with private loans and other sources and have their children take on a lot more debt than they actually can afford to take on. So the transparency is a huge issue. And there has been some efforts, but, you know, very piecemeal and small around the country to kind of remove the veil around the financing of college and see how it actually might assist in people making decisions and better informed decisions about their college choice.
You know, Fenneva, I was curious about how this affects students of color, because mm-hmm. I know that coming out of the recession, a lot of the, you know, familial wealth among families of color was stripped away because a lot of that wealth was in homes and the values of homes declined. And so I was looking at some numbers here. That student loan, there was a study that came out recently that student loan debt held by black and white borrowers grows both by 6.8%. But black young adults end up with well over many percentages higher of student loan debt because they bring less to the table, right, to try to pay down the student mm-hmm. loan debt. I've got to believe that that's discouraging many, many students of color from making the kind of choices that Suzanne was talking about, or even perceiving that they can afford college. What have you seen in that?
Right. So I think you might be referencing some of my own work where we're looking at both the accumulation and repayment of student loans over the young adulthood period and mm-hmm. finding that the rates of payback are slower for black young adults. And what is really, I think, coming out of this work is looking at how it's a combination of not just the educational system, but in combination with the labor market and the labor market that these students are entering into, that they have to work in tandem, right? So if they're underemployed or having trouble with unemployment, then they can't pay back these loans to the same degree and at the same rates as their white young adult counterparts. So that's, I think, where it becomes a little discouraging because you're doing all the right things, right? You're good. You're being told, go to college, finish college, get your degree. But then you're entering into a market that may not be valuing you to the same extent or to the same degree as, with the same credentialing as your white counterparts.
For everybody who's tweeting me about, hey, it's not all about a college degree. You don't have that. Yes, you might have missed the beginning of the show when we talked about the need for some kind of advanced training, advanced certification, or a college degree, with the acknowledgement that you need something, some kind of certification, advanced training, college degree to thrive in this economy. But what we're really asking here is how that bargain looks for what you have to pay for it, what you have to borrow for it and pay back. How does that look once you've achieved the degree, the certification, the training? Our guest this hour, Julie Margetta Morgan. She's a fellow of the Roosevelt Institute, where she specializes in college affordability and finance issues. And Feniba Otto is an assistant professor of consumer science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. So I want to know if what you spent and borrowed for higher education or some kind of advanced training has ended up being a fair bargain for you. And I'd ask you to think about this both short and long term. Yeah, the pain in the short term of making these payments. How does it look in the rearview mirror as well? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter at CarrieMPR, where Aaron says, I teach at Minnesota State Mankato, and my students are very concerned about debt. Perhaps they see the strain it's put on their parents. By working and attending a school that only cost $8,000 a year, most of them are able to graduate with significantly less debt. Nina says, it was my master's degree that was the change maker. My increased salary in the first year was more than my 2 years' tuition. I received some merit grants. Julie, we haven't even talked about how when you graduate from some kind of certification, advanced training, college, with a lot of debt, that's gonna influence your decisions about going on for advanced education, isn't it? What do you see in that? How do people make decisions on that?
Sure, I think it does. I think the debt weighs heavily on people in terms of where they go for advanced degrees or whether they take on advanced degrees. In the overall scope of the $1.5 trillion in student debt, a pretty hefty portion of that is for people who are pursuing graduate degrees. So I'm not sure whether we see it slowing down their choices there. But I think the other area of choices that we need to look at is the types of jobs that people pursue. So are people pursuing jobs that are, you know, good for them and good for our economy overall, or are they going towards the things that they know will help them pay down their debt?
Well, how do you judge that?
Well, I mean, if you look at people who, you know, we always worry about forgiving or canceling debt for people who are going into fields like law or people who are becoming doctors, right? Because we think that they've gotten some sort of ticket to a very fancy earnings based on their debt. But we also have huge shortages within those fields in the more public interest sides, right? So we don't have as much solo practitioner doctors in rural areas. We don't have the legal aid lawyers that we need. And so the debt is forcing people to make choices that are not necessarily good for them and not necessarily good for society overall.
Oh. Call here from Sarah Beth in Minneapolis. Hi, Sarah Beth. What's your situation?
Hi. So I'm a graduating senior at the University of Minnesota this year, and I have a business degree. I already have my postgraduate job.
Accepted. Good.
Thank you. Yeah, but it's interesting because my tuition, so what I'm coming out and really my degree that I'm getting and the wages that I'm being offered is really no higher than what my father, who also got a business degree from an even more prestigious university, the University of Michigan, back in the 80s. I'm still making the same wages that he did out of college.
Really?
It's, honestly, it's about $45,000 to $50,000 to starting, and you're seeing that, you know, it's not matching up with inflation at all.
Yeah. I mean, this is, I don't think I asked you about this. This is what I was mentioning early, where you look at median income for a bachelor's degree and you see how it just flattened out between 99 and 2017. You've invested all of this money. The wages are not keeping pace with that. And I think we see that in the job and wage reports year to year. Do you have a sense about how that affects, you know, the way people are managing these loans and the decisions that they make about that they're making about borrowing.
Yeah, that's not that's a big question. It's a big question, right? How to tackle that question? I can speak to, I guess, a little bit maybe where we're going with this, or what we are seeing happening is that because of stagnating wages, I think this is leading to, as Julie was talking about, this the returns to a college degree being more and more. Mm-hmm. You know, needed, and the bottom falling out at the lower ends of the distribution, right? So the people who don't have the degree or have some college not getting the returns. And as the caller was referencing, like, you know, comparing herself to her dad, what may potentially happen is that she may need to, or may feel like she needs to go back and get more schooling, right? So there comes additional, maybe the need to take on more debt to raise that income, right? Because if the returns to a four-year aren't enough, then how do people, you know, what's the signaling that they're receiving that they need to, you know, to increase their income, increase their wages, is to go back and get more additional schooling and take on more debt to do so. Mm. So it's, you know, it's leading to this spiraling of
if I want to make the money, I need the higher education. To get the higher education, I'm already in debt for the undergrad, and now I'm piling on more borrowing. And I know grad school is not cheap. Julie, another thing you wanted to add to that?
Well, I, you know, again, just thinking about the two sides of the equation here, we often think about higher education from, it's very natural to think about it from the student perspective and in our insular world of higher education policy as what can students do to attain higher levels of skills, right? But there's a whole other side to this, which is how has power been shaped within the labor market, right? So we see this increasing concentration of power within larger employers in the labor market. And then we see the decline of the institutions that traditionally protected worker power, like labor unions. So there's a whole other story here that, as Sanoa noted, it's natural for individuals to feel like, hey, I'm not getting the returns to my degree, and the next step is to get a higher level of education in the hopes that that will produce the return. But they're up against policy decisions that have been made over the last 20 years that have resulted in a labor market that is stacked against them.
Yeah, good point. To Abigail in Burnsville. Hey, Abigail, thank you so much for waiting. Really curious to hear your story, though, on this.
Yeah, not a problem. So my husband and I are first and second generation college students. And currently our combined debt from his doctorate and from my master's degree is a little over $80,000.
Oh, wow. Ouch.
Yeah, it hurts. We're currently expecting our first baby, and so our family looks at us like we're insane. They think, what are you doing? You have all of this debt. You have a baby coming. Like, they honestly think we're going crazy. And my husband and I sometimes feel like we're going crazy because it's so difficult in the short term. But when we look at the long-term benefits of what our degrees are getting us and what our loans are helping us do, mm-hmm. it's so completely worth it because we're going to be able to give our child the childhood that we wanted that we couldn't have while our parents were working two or three part-time and full-time jobs. Yeah. And we're going to be able to have financial security later in life that our parents still don't have. And so when we look at what we're trying to accomplish in the long term, it's completely worth it.
You know, your call really, I think, points us to something that I wanted to talk about that we heard about in this Millennial Economy show that we did. So, Julie and Fenibud, this was a show where we asked millennials to call in, and so many said, if not for the student loan debt, I'd be buying a house, having kids, you know, making some of these decisions, but this student loan debt is pushing all that back. I know you've both looked at research on how this is affecting this generation. Julie, what do you pull out of that?
I mean, what the millennials are telling you is what we see from the data. It is affecting their decision making about these longer term sort of so-called adult decisions, like having children,
right,
and starting small businesses. And I think our work tries to emphasize the fact that these aren't, it's not just affecting individual decisions. These are the decisions that help grow our economy. So people buying homes, starting small businesses, saving for retirement are not just good for them. They're good for all of us. So we really need to be treating the changing patterns resulting from student loan debt as a policy problem rather than an individual one.
Let me just quote the head of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, on this. He thinks that, as you've noted, Julie, this may hold back economic growth. He adds, as people live with their parents or cohabit with a non-partner or roommate, presumably, millions of houses and apartments aren't being purchased. Neither is Wi-Fi or that extra sofa. We think this is having a significant impact on the economy. Fenneba, do you hear this from, I don't know, your students and beyond about, you know, moving up into that kind of that next echelon of adulthood?
Yes, I do. I think, you know, I think the research and the studies point to and speak to the real concerns of millennials who are fearful that they may not be able to make the investments in the time that they have, you know, they're expected to make those transitions or transition to home ownership or transitions into marriage. And so we do see this. I think also it's important to point out that, you know, if we look to education and higher education as an engine of economic mobility and stability, then it puts this new cohort, this new cohort of young millennials, in a very precarious situation, right? That they view maybe middle class attainment as very temporary or stressful, and rather than the, you know, a place of security and comfort and stability. So it's very, you know, it's very interesting and important to talk about, you know, how these young millennials are experiencing this young adulthood period and what they see for their future.
Let me make sure I understand what you're saying there, that you're saying if the anticipation of that next phase of your life feels unsure, you're not very confident about your financial stability, that has kind of a ripple effect through the economy and the emotional experience of that generation?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, we think researchers, you know, social scientists think about, you know, the lived experience over the life course. And it is framed not just by the macro experiences that individuals experience, but, you know, the shared experiences that they live through together. Right. And so this student loan, I think, is the student loan debt crisis, whatever, repayment crisis, whichever, however you want to refer to it, is something that millennials are experiencing together. And I think if we look back, you know, previous generations, you know, people who have gone to college, you know, the experience of actually thinking about debt while going through the college is pretty unique to this this generation, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, thinking about how am I going to pay it while also accumulating it, I think is pretty unique.
I wanted to play just a few of the comments that we got on that show. As I said, that show wasn't really about student loan debt, but that came up in so many of the calls. Listen.
Financially, to get the capital together to buy a house was just impossible. We already have a mortgage. It's our grad school loan.
Yeah.
I actually went to testify in the Minnesota Senate to provide some student loan debt relief, but that tax credit was still less than 1 month's worth of student loan payments. Why are we taking on all this debt if it's not going to provide the income opportunities that we were told it would?
Voices of some of our millennial callers when we talked about how having student loan debt and what the millennial economy feels like. To the phones here to Carol in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hi, Carol.
Hi, Carrie. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Happily streaming Minnesota Public Radio.
Okay. Glad to hear it.
I'm calling because thank you for doing this show. The one thing I would love for your guests to address is the idea of default rates as an indicator of how much a student values their education. Mm. And of course, there's a whole host of variables there. You know, are they getting jobs? Are they graduating in 4 years from undergrad? And I call because a couple of reasons. We have a student who's a daughter who's a first year student. We have a recent grad from college. And also, my husband and I have both worked in higher ed for 25 years. I was a professor at St. Thomas for 20 years. And now we're over here at St. Norbert College Green Bay, Wisconsin.
Right.
And our default rate, for instance, here is only 1.8%. When you compare it to private colleges in Wisconsin, the average is 7.6%. And the average default rate in Wisconsin is 10.5%. And one of the things that I implore students and parents to do is ask, when they're considering a college or university, ask what their default rate is. Because what we're finding, for instance, and I've seen this across the country, is that when students value their education, they're much more likely to pay back those loans.
So Carol, you are positing the idea that there's some connection between the value that you place on the education and your willingness or capability to pay it back. Is that right?
One of the key variables.
Julie,
it is something that's not often addressed.
Julie, what do you think?
It's a really interesting question. I would say I do not think that the level to which students value their education is the key to figuring out how to lower default rates, or is the key to whether or not students pay back their debt. I think there are a lot of factors that go into this. First of all, finishing your education. So students who drop out of school, particularly, you know, students who drop out of like a for-profit college are much more likely to default on their debt. So there's that, I guess. You know, perhaps you could say you don't value a degree that you didn't finish, but I think it's about attaining the credential there. But I also want to say schools can do things to manage their default rates. So some of this is about the resources that the school has and the resources that the school is able to invest in managing their default rates. But there are other factors that, I mean, there's just so many factors that go into this. So, for example, community colleges maybe taking on students who have attended and dropped out of a for-profit college and already come in with debt, which makes them more likely to then default on any subsequent debt that they attain. But I think there are just a lot of different factors here.
A call here from Annika in Bemidji. Annika, it sounds like you're in this situation of having borrowed but not finished a degree. Is that right?
Yeah, I started a four-year degree for geology and ended up having to leave after 3 years due to health issues. So I have about $35,000 in debt between private and federal loans. And so it's like I have the debt of a college degree, but not the actual degree to show for it.
Right. What are you doing now?
I'm currently unemployed because of health things, but I'm looking at starting back at school again. But this time I'm looking at a local school, public school instead of a private college, and looking to do cybersecurity because there's actually jobs in that.
You know, I wish you some good health and that you get kind of you get back into the field that you want to be in and you can complete it, because being in debt for a degree that you can't use is kind of the worst of all the situations.
Yeah.
Thanks for the call. Yeah. I wanted to ask you, Feniba, if when we talk about degrees and certifications, so many of these borrowers never complete it, and whether this is kind of a self-fulfilling cycle, right? You have to leave the education institution to earn money to start paying on the loans that you've borrowed. But that's probably also going to be a discouragement to get back into education, because now you're into this, I need money to pay it off and to live. What does the research say about that?
Well, absolutely. Like the people or the non-completers or people that have some college and have the debt, we see. So one of the things I want to point out is, you know, that we look at average student loans debt and those among defaulters, the average is around, you know, what we consider not these exorbitant amounts that we often hear in the media, right?
Right.
It's like 5,000 or 10,000. It's small amounts of money. Yeah. But, you know, as we've been kind of saying over the course of the hour, we also have to look to the labor market. Why are people who have such low or, you know, not as high debt loads struggling to pay back $5,000 worth of debt or $10,000 worth of debt, right? you know, are they not finding the jobs that are paying them wages that they can, you know, make ends meet? Are they struggling to also pay additional bills, utilities, other debts, you know, medical debt? I'm not sure if your caller has medical debt, but that is also, you know, there's other things on the household balance sheet that may be competing, you know, for the wages that they're bringing into the household. So, yeah, it's really, you know, and so we have, you know, no degree, so they're not getting the returns that a college degree may get them. But they're also, you know, have this debt load that's on their balance sheet.
So, Julie, yeah. I find that notable that, again, as Feniba suggests, this isn't I've got $75,000 in debt, I don't know how to pay it down. That small of an amount, what does that say? What does that tell you?
Well, I mean, I think it tells us something about a bit about the value of a college degree, right? We've spent a lot of time focusing on the fact that they're not as valuable as they ought to be they could be or as people expect them to be. But on the other hand, we do see in the figures that people who don't finish a degree have a harder time repaying than people who do. People who attain graduate degrees are a little bit more likely to repay, right? So there's, you know, there is some value there that that increases the stability of a person's ability to repay. I think, you know, to me the danger, I think it's really, really important to point out the struggles that these low balance borrowers are having. I worry when we focus only on repayment as the thing that we need to solve in the student debt crisis, right?
Yeah.
Because even for people who are repaying their debt, as we mentioned earlier, it's holding them back in ways that matter both deeply to them individually and to our economy. So we need to be able to figure out how to solve both problems.
You know, I was reading an interview that J.P. Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon did. There's a guy who has no problem paying back his student loans, by the way, because he makes a lot of money. But he was talking about the necessity for better student loan products, and he was talking about how fast direct lending to students has grown. I think he said over 500% over the last 10 years, and it's not all been responsible lending. Do either of you, Julie, something to say about how these student loan products work, and could they be better? That's something I've never really talked about on the show.
Well, certainly there are ways to improve both the product itself. When we're talking about the federal student loan, which is really the bulk of the debt that's out there, so about $1.5 trillion in just federal student loans,
mm-hmm.
we can improve the product itself in terms of the repayment plans that are available. I think it's also crucial to remember that we can improve just the way that that product is being implemented. The federal government employs private and both for-profit and non-profit servicers and debt collectors, many of whom have repeatedly broken the rules and violated their contracts without any repercussions. So there are a lot of improvements we can make there. In terms of the private student loan products, I've been, you know, following some of the more, quote-unquote, innovative practices there, and I think we should have a lot of concern about what we see coming out there, that we're reinventing debt products that don't even have the same basic consumer protections as the products that are available.
Okay. I think you just said you've been following what is thought of to be as innovative loan
yeah.
products in the private loan industry, and you say beware because
yeah.
they're not what they purport to be. Okay, good. It's a good message. Feniba, something you want to do to put in there on that?
Yeah, I mean, I just want to piggyback off of what Julie was saying. I think we have to be looking not just at the repayment, but also, you know, the accumulation process and what can we do about college, you know, rising college costs and, you know, how families are thinking about how taking out loans and the loans that they're taking out to pay for college, you know. People always ask me, like, what's my quick advice to anyone sending a student to college? And, you know, until we see real, you know, real policy that's going to talk about rising costs of college, I say, you know, get in, get done, and as quickly as possible. Because,
And try not
to borrow.
An amount of money you're going to be, you know, even if it doesn't feel like it, that you could be paying back for a decade. Right, after. Right. Audrey says, I have $67,000 in student loan debt. My initial loan was for $60,000. After paying back my loan for 4 years, my balance only continues to go up. Ugh. Audrey, I feel your pain there. To Jessica in Minnetonka, Jessica, I'm afraid I only have a couple minutes, but I wanted to hear what you had to say on this.
Yeah, I'd just like to speak quickly on forgiveness. I'm over here saying prayers that the government will honor forgiveness programs.
Yes.
I have two master's degrees and 4 kids.
Whoa.
And I'm proud of what I did. I'm glad of going through it, and I can see that I have a job that makes a difference in the world. And I am on the forgiveness program. And at work, we're trying to figure out forgiveness programs that were student loan programs we can offer new employees.
Mm-hmm.
Where, and I know different employers are starting to do that, where instead of just a 401k, they're saying, how about instead we give $100 each month your student loans? And then also we're a nonprofit. So after 10 years, theoretically, your loans will be forgiven.
Mm.
So essentially we're covering your student loan payments until that 10-year time period. I'm just curious if you could speak on that.
Yeah, Julie, is there innovation in forgiveness? Because I know the federal government, this has been kind of on and off about how that program works.
Yeah, there's a lot of things in that question. So I'll start with the benefits from employers. I think it's great to see employers recognizing that student debt is a problem and that helping people repay their debt is a way to recruit people into jobs. I think it's problematic to me when we see them making the trade-off between helping people save for retirement and helping them pay their student debt. I'd like to see them doing both, and
right.
I don't think it's too much to ask. On the piece around forgiveness, yes, we've seen huge problems with the existing student debt cancellation programs. We have cancellation for borrowers who engage in public service. We have more limited programs for people with total or permanent disabilities and for people who were defrauded by their colleges. And across the board, it's much, much harder than it should be, and in some cases, nearly impossible for borrowers to get what is essentially a legal right under the Higher Education Act. And so I think it speaks to both the need for better accountability and administration for the existing programs, but also toward moving towards much simpler cancellation programs that, you know, just recognize the fact that the debt is a problem for individuals and a problem for the economy and are more self-executing instead of asking people to go through 10 years of an application process only to find out that they won't get what
Julie,
they deserve.
Afraid I have to wrap it. Thank you so much for being part of the show. Feniba, thank you. Really good to have all the advice and the insight on this. By the way, at noon, we have an APM program on apprenticeship. You can hear that from APM Reports at noon.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to the discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet us at @CarrieMPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@npr.org.